to this special episode of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Audrey Sternberg. As part of its OncView program, Cancer Network hosted a discussion with Lori Wirth, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Medical Director of the Center for Head and Neck Cancers at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, who shared her perspective on updates in the treatment of second-line radioiodine refractory differentiated thyroid cancer, or DTC.
So let's really just start at the top. And I was just asking if you could provide a brief overview of differentiated thyroid cancer, and we'll refer to that as DTC now because that is a mouthful.
Right. So differentiated thyroid cancer really is a spectrum of thyroid cancers. The most common differentiated thyroid cancer is a papillary thyroid cancer. We also see follicular thyroid cancers, Hürthle cell carcinomas, and poorly differentiated thyroid cancers that all fall under that umbrella of DTC. It's interesting because they have a lot in common. They all arise from the follicular cell in the thyroid gland, but those various subtypes of differentiated thyroid cancer do have different molecular drivers and also different natural histories. So when it's convenient, we lump them together. When we need to get into specifics, we divvy them up.
Perfect. And so when looking at patients, I'll ask you a two-part question here. How do patients with DTC typically present, and how are they diagnosed?
Mm-hmm. So patients who present with problems that ultimately lead to a diagnosis of DTC can have a mass in the thyroid gland that's picked up incidentally on some other imaging modality for some other problem. Say somebody was in a car crash and they had a neck CT, for example, or a PET CT scan for another problem, and there will be an FDG avid mass in the thyroid gland that then leads to a diagnosis. And that accounts for a fairly large number of differentiated thyroid cancers that we find. With clinical presentation, the most common presentation is that the patient notices a lump in their neck, or a healthcare provider like a primary care physician or an OBGYN person will palpate on a physical examination a mass. Generally, then patients will have an ultrasound. If there are characteristics on the ultrasound that warrant a fine needle aspiration, then that's typically the next step in the diagnostic workup of a thyroid mass.
And I think that leads nicely into this next question, which is, what is the typical disease course and prognosis for patients with DTC?
Well, so most patients with DTC really have a disease that carries a very good prognosis. So most patients with DTC these days will have surgery first to address their disease. However, there are a lot of nuances to what the best surgical approach is based on the type of DTC it is, as well as the extent of disease. So a patient who has a small, say 2-centimeter papillary thyroid cancer, primary tumor based on fine needle aspiration and no suspicious lymph nodes in the neck, might be able to get away with just a hemithyroidectomy. But in general, most patients will have surgery first. If patients have, from a surgical point of view, intermediate risk or high risk disease, meaning that there's a risk that the cancer could come back either local, regionally, or distantly after surgery, those patients in general will go on and have an adjuvant dose of radioactive iodine.
Perfect. And to conclude this section, could you comment on some of the challenges you've encountered with DTC treatment?
Sure. So, you know, for the initial approach to patients with the typical DTC, garden variety DTC, I think there are two challenges. One challenge that we've realized is very important to be aware of is that we have been over-treating a significant number of patients who present with very early stage disease, particularly if patients have a thyroid nodule that's less than 1 centimeter centimeter in size or less than 1.5 centimeters in size. Not all of those patients actually need to go on to have surgery. And by not over-treating patients with very early stage disease that's indolent, we can avoid complications from surgical management of these cases. Also, we've realized, I think, that we're over-treating a number of patients with radioactive iodine. So there has been a reevaluation of where radioactive iodine is of benefit and where it isn't absolutely necessary. So managing the proper treatment to not over-treat patients with good prognostic disease is very important. And then on the other hand, I think another challenge is being able to recognize patients in their initial presentation of DTC who are at higher risk for having disease recurrence or developing distant metastatic disease in the future, and making sure that their initial treatment strategies are optimized so that the best surgery is done from the get-go, so that they get radioactive iodine when it's indicated, and then that they have proper follow-up given the fact that they're at higher risk for disease recurrence.
Dr. Wirth, let's get into some of the frontline treatment options for radioiodine refractory DTC. How exactly do you define radioiodine refractory DTC?
So I think from a medical oncology point of view, it is important to know that there is a definition for radioiodine refractory differentiated thyroid cancer. This isn't something that we learn in our oncology fellowships necessarily, but we want to make sure that patients who need treatment for their DTC aren't going to be best treated with radioactive iodine if we're going to be giving them cancer drugs. So there is a definition of radioactive iodine refractory thyroid cancer that's been laid out by the American Thyroid Association, and the ATA guidelines do go into detail. There are four criteria for iodine refractory differentiated thyroid cancer, but just basically to be simple about it, if patients have known deposits of thyroid cancer and they've had radioactive iodine treatment or a scan with radioactive iodine, then they have a nuclear medicine scan and those deposits of thyroid cancer don't take up radioactive iodine, they have iodine refractory disease. Or if patients have some spots of disease that take up radioactive iodine, but others that don't, that also counts as iodine refractory disease. Another criteria is if a patient has been treated with radioactive iodine, but in a short period of time, such as 12 or 14 months, their cancer progresses, then the radioactive iodine didn't do them any good. So that counts as well. And then lastly, it's felt that at some point, if a patient has received more and more radioactive iodine and they still have persistent thyroid cancer, that there's really little benefit to further radioactive iodine. There's not a great cutoff of that total dose from a research point of view, but it's generally accepted that around 600 millicuries or 800 millicuries of radioactive iodine is about the maximum that in general most people should be getting.
So are there clinical and molecular features more or less likely to be associated with refractoriness to radioiodine?
Indeed, there are both clinical and molecular features. So in general, there are some histologies that are more likely to be sensitive to radioactive iodine. So a classic variant papillary thyroid cancer is more likely to be sensitive. There are subtypes of papillary thyroid cancers that are more aggressive, the most common of which is a tall cell variant. That goes along very frequently with a BRAF V600E mutation. Those cancers tend to be less likely to take up radioactive iodine. And then other diagnoses as well, particularly Hürthle cell thyroid carcinomas and poorly differentiated thyroid carcinomas, are less likely to take up radioactive iodine. And then from a molecular point of view, the mutation BRAF V600E is the most common mutation driver mutation that we see in differentiated thyroid cancers. That's the most common mutation that we see in papillary thyroid cancers that are the most common DTC. And when a BRAF V600E mutation is present, it upregulates the MAP kinase pathway. That goes along with downregulation of things like the sodium iodine symporter that gets radioactive iodine into cells. So thyroid cancers that harbor BRAF V600E is one of the most common molecular features, especially if that's coexistent with another mutation in the TERT promoter.
Right. And I wanted to ask you what factors you take into consideration when deciding between starting treatment immediately and active surveillance for patients with RRDTC.
So Matthew, I like that question very much because it's one that I struggle with on a daily basis in clinic. So the decision to start treatment with MKIs for patients with iodine refractory DTC can be easy, can be a no-brainer, and in other cases can be difficult. So the no-brainer cases are patients who have iodine refractory disease who have enough disease so that they're symptomatic. They can't wait around to get better. And patients who are more symptomatic generally don't respond as well to our therapies as well. So patients who are symptomatic from walking through the clinic door, I think should be started on therapy in general. Or patients who have so much disease that they're going to be symptomatic very soon. Those patients need to start therapy now as well. On the other end of the spectrum are patients with very low volume disease where they're clearly asymptomatic and they're not going to be symptomatic anytime soon. I think that most of us in general take the approach that we should at least follow those patients by active surveillance or disease monitoring for some time to get a handle on the pace of disease. Some patients will have very slowly progressive disease, and they probably don't need to start any therapy other than levothyroxine to keep their TSH suppressed. And I followed a number of patients for a number of years in that category who are perfectly fine, and I don't want to mess with that. It's really the middle category where it can be difficult when patients have moderate volume disease that's slow growing, or low volume disease but more rapidly growing. And you know, there aren't numbers necessarily that we can pin on this, but that's where I think it's challenging. There are some data from subset analyses from the SELECT trial, however, that I think provides some guidance. For example, we've recently seen that when patients with iodine refractory DTC have lung mets, and then were randomized to lenvatinib or placebo, those patients that had lung mets that were as small as 1 centimeter in size actually had an overall survival benefit compared to the patients that were randomized to placebo, even though almost 90% of the patients that were randomized to placebo crossed over and received lenvatinib at the time of progression at a median of only 4 months. So that suggests that for patients who have lung metastases, if an overall survival benefit is one of the most important things, that we don't want to wait too long to initiate therapy. There have been some other subset analyses as well that suggest that in general, when patients have progressive disease, there's more clinical benefit with efficacy, you know, response rates, progression-free survival, when treatment is initiated a little bit earlier rather than a little bit later.
Right. And so for those patients that are showing symptoms that you decided you wanted to start with treatment, what are some of the frontline options for this group of patients that you're considering?
Mm-hmm. Well, in this day and age, I think that we do want to make sure that we've done molecular testing in all of the patients that we're starting on systemic therapies for iodine refractory DTC, because there are some actionable alterations that we don't want to miss. And the treatment, the molecular diagnosis, the molecular diagnostics can take some time to get. So I generally order that testing earlier while I'm beginning to think about systemic therapy for patients. And we can identify patients that harbor RET fusions or NTRK fusions. And in the US, RET and NTRK directed therapy is FDA approved for patients with iodine refractory progressive DTC, and those approvals are line agnostic. So molecular diagnostics are important. If patients don't have an actionable alteration or they have a BRAF V600E mutation, which is not uncommon finding, and those patients need therapy in general, I prefer, and I think most of my colleagues prefer, starting with an MKI therapy, particularly because for the BRAF V600E mutation patients, so far in phase two studies, we haven't seen that BRAF-directed therapy outperforms lenvatinib data from the SELECT trial. So in general, we don't use BRAF-directed therapy off-label for those patients. And in general, for patients who don't have a RET fusion or NTRK fusion driving their thyroid cancer, I will start patients on lenvatinib as the first-line MKI.
Right. And so you kind of got into this next question a little bit regarding lenvatinib. So I'll focus on sorafenib. You know, which patient is most suitable for sorafenib treatment?
So the patients that were enrolled in the SELECT trial with lenvatinib were a little bit different than the patients that were enrolled in the DECISION trial with sorafenib. The patients in the lenvatinib trial had a little bit more aggressive disease, for example. So that might be one thing for providers to take into account. There's a slightly different side effect profile with lenvatinib and sorafenib as well. So with lenvatinib, we do see more frequent grade 3 or 4 hypertension than is seen with sorafenib, though we can see hypertension. Hypertension is a class effect with all of these drugs. So you can definitely see it with sorafenib as well. So if I'm taking care of a patient who has hypertension that's already kind of difficult to manage, they might already be on 3 antihypertensive drugs, they could have difficulty with blood pressure control with lenvatinib. So that would be a good patient to consider sorafenib with the first line therapy rather than lenvatinib. So those nuances with the side effect profile, I think, are important to consider.
I'm glad you brought up the toxicities, because that's where I want to close this section of our conversation on. What toxicities have been observed following treatment with frontline TKIs, and how are they typically managed?
The side effect profile with the VEGFR multikinase inhibitors really is fairly consistent from drug to drug, though there are some finer nuances. But in general, we see hypertension, diarrhea, fatigue, hand-foot syndrome, some mild transaminitis as common side effects across these VEGFR multikinase inhibitors. I think it's important, particularly with thyroid cancer, and particularly because we're often following patients with active surveillance for some time before starting an MKI, that we think about prehabilitation in these patients, focusing on blood pressure control, making sure that patients have well-controlled blood pressure before we start them on therapies. And also, we do see over time, along with the diarrhea and fatigue, we see weight loss, we see some loss of muscle mass, and you know, people just kind of poop out. We think that if you can help patients get involved in things that can really help with a healthy, leading a healthy lifestyle, that can really kind of help prepare them for the road ahead as well. So I like to encourage people to get good exercise, to get into a healthy diet habits if they don't already do so, and then do some gentle weight bearing exercise to help maintain their body mass. And then on treatment, of course, it's important to really take care of these patients. These are not patients who you can start on an oral drug and have them come back for restaging scans 2 weeks later. The hypertension onset can be very quick. So I have patients monitor their blood pressure at home, and I give them instructions on when to call when their blood pressure goes up. And we don't kind of, you know, wait and see what's going to happen with their blood pressure. If we see hypertension emerging in general, we start antihypertensive therapy earlier rather than waiting to see how bad it's going to get. The other tricky thing, of course, is diarrhea, and diet modifications can help a lot. Over-the-counter treatments such as with Imodium help a lot. And I always like to get our dietitian colleagues involved with patients earlier rather than later, because the things that we normally kind of think to tell patients to take to fatten up also can often precipitate diarrhea in patients. So just having them take, you know, milkshakes and ice cream often makes the diarrhea worse. And so it can be tricky actually to manage the combination of diarrhea and weight loss for patients. And the other thing that I do a lot is I circle back with patients on these diet approaches, because nobody wants to, stick with a boring, dull diarrhea diet for day after day, week after week, month after month. People get tired and they, want to enjoy themselves, but it's good to, let people do that and then circle back and try to rein things in again at some point in the future.
Dr. Wirth, let's take a look at now treatment options in RAI refractory DTC in the second line and beyond. What factors do you consider when selecting the appropriate treatment in second line or beyond setting?
Well, that would have been a harder question to answer if you had asked me a year ago, but now fortunately we have some new data from the COSMIC 311 trial. So we've now got great guidance on second line therapy for iodine refractory DTC. The COSMIC 311 trial randomized patients who had progressed on prior therapy for DTC, and it was primarily VEGFR multikinase therapy, particularly with lenvatinib, but there were other drugs that were allowed as well. And patients were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to cabozantinib versus placebo. And the COSMIC 311 trial showed that there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival in the patients that were randomized to cabozantinib compared to placebo, with a hazard ratio that was really, really good. The hazard ratio was 0.2. So it was on the basis of the COSMIC 311 trial that the FDA approved cabozantinib in the second line setting for patients with iodine refractory DTC. So it's great to have those data. I think in general, we now have 3 VEGFR multikinase inhibitors that are approved. Both lenvatinib and sorafenib have approvals in the first line. And then cabozantinib now has an approval in the second line. So we've got 2 drugs for 2 lines of therapy. So should we use sorafenib because it's approved for the first line, and then use cabozantinib in the second line? I think in general, the answer is probably no. And the reason why I say that is because we also have to look at the sequence of therapies. And in the sorafenib trial, we just didn't have patients that had been previously treated that were enrolled in that trial. So we don't really know how well sorafenib might perform in the second line. It's an open question. Whereas we do know with good data from a randomized trial that cabozantinib performs well in the second line setting. So my usual sequence is lenvatinib is first line and cabozantinib in the second line. Of course, if there are the genotype directed therapies that are available, those need to be worked in appropriately as well. If, for example, a patient has had an MPI in the first line and they have a RET fusion or NTRK fusion, I would certainly use one of the NTRK or RET-directed therapies in those patients prior to cabozantinib because of the good activity that we've seen in the phase 1/2 trials in those patient populations. And then there's the question, of course, of the BRAF V600E mutation. There is a clinical trial that's underway right now investigating dabrafenib and trametinib in the second line setting in BRAF mutant iodine refractory DTC. That's an international trial. So we'll have good data at some point in the hopefully not too distant future on whether or not there's a role for BRAF directed therapy for these patients.
Right. And my next question was around COSMIC 311. So I think you did a really great job of kind of talking a bit about that and really surveying the treatment landscape, including cabozantinib. So I wanted to ask you what your experience has been using cabozantinib for the treatment of DTC.
Well, so first of all, I would say that what I first found in using cabozantinib for DTC was that I had to make sure that I was distinguishing it from cabozantinib for MTC. So there are different formulations of cabozantinib for DTC and for MTC. And it's very important to make sure that you're ordering the right cabozantinib at the right dose for DTC and not what you're doing for your MTC patients. And the first prescription that I wrote for cabozantinib for DTC, my specialty pharmacy called me and said, you know, after I had spent like an hour making sure I was ordering it the right way, my specialty pharmacy said, Dr. Wirth, didn't you mean to order? And so that is a potential pitfall in terms of a medical error that we want to make sure that we're not ordering. But I have certainly begun to use it as my standard of care for our patients. What I'd say is so far so good.
With cabozantinib treatment, what are some of the common toxicities you see with it and how are they managed?
With cabozantinib and DTC, we see a similar adverse event profile that we do with the other VEGFR multikinase inhibitors. So we do see our old friends, diarrhea, hypertension, fatigue. You can see transaminitis in these patients. Occasionally, we can see QTC prolongation. So we have to monitor patients' blood pressure, their labs. We have to check baseline labs and EKGs in patients and monitor those things on treatment. There is a kind of a unique toxicity where cabozantinib can affect the pigmentation of people's skin, also their hair. So many patients will develop a bit of a pallor and lose the pigmentation in their hair. And I definitely mention that to patients to expect when I'm consenting patients for treatment with cabozantinib. Most patients do experience those pigmentation changes, which is really kind of interesting. But overall, you know, I would say that cabozantinib at this FDA-approved dose is well tolerated in patients. And these are patients that in general have been on prior VEGFR MKIs, and many of them have been on prior VEGFR MKIs for many months. And so far in, you know, my anecdotal experience, I found that treatment with cabozantinib is very doable. And similarly to the COSMIC-311 study, we do see patients responding to therapy or having minor responses and at least not progressing.
Dr. Wirth, looking ahead a little bit, what are some of remaining unmet needs in the treatment of RAI refractory DTC?
Well, of course, there are a number of unmet needs. We don't cure most patients, unfortunately, with our treatment approaches, and that's what we all want. So we've got treatments that are really highly efficacious, but we're greedy, and that's just never enough. And of course, majority of patients do go on to develop disease progression. So we'd love to capitalize on that really good a very high and durable response rate that we see with drugs like lenvatinib. We've explored the combination of pembrolizumab and lenvatinib, but that's only in a small phase 2 trial. So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen there in the future. The other area where there's a lot of interest and we've seen a lot of small phase 2 studies is the idea of redifferentiation, which basically means using systemic therapy to modify the thyroid cancer cells so that they'll respond once again to radioactive iodine. And we know that some of the molecular alterations like the BRAF-V600E mutations, the RET fusions and NTRK fusions, do lead to the loss of the thyroid cancer cell's ability to take up radioactive iodine. So there are some efforts underway to study redifferentiation, including a study that's underway looking at targeting the RET fusion pathway along with radioactive iodine in patients with iodine refractory RET fusion positive DTC. I think the other unmet need is that we don't really understand what the mechanisms of resistance to the VEGFR multikinase inhibitors are. We have a much better handle on emerging acquired resistance mechanisms with a gene-specific therapy. And so we're making progress with second-line RET and NTRK inhibitors as a result of that. But there's a big black box for why do patients who respond so beautifully to, say, lenvatinib or cabozantinib go on and develop acquired resistance? And that we still don't understand.
And you mentioned one or two of these already, so there's not much. If you don't have much to add, that's all right. But are there any trials in development or ongoing that you're particularly excited about that are going to kind of read out the results in the near future?
There are a couple of trials that I am very excited about. The clinical trials investigating dabrafenib and trametinib in BRAF mutant iodine refractory PTC in the second line setting, I think is a very important trial. Next generation RET and TREK inhibitor trials are very important. And there are a number of different agents that are being studied in that setting as well that I think are important trials. And then another important effort that's underway is getting back to the very beginning of our discussion with thyroid cancer in making sure that we're not over-treating patients with thyroid cancer. So there are a number of efforts looking at how patients do with active surveillance for very early stage thyroid cancers without even undergoing surgery. So those are important studies that I want to not forget to mention as well.
Right. And so to conclude our conversation, Dr. Wirth, what advice do you have for community oncologists treating patients with RAI refractory DTC?
Well, listen, I admire community oncologists who really know so much more about oncology than I do. I have a deep knowledge and on a very rare cancer type, and I think it's challenging for me to take care of patients with breast cancer and lung cancer. But I think it's very challenging for community oncologists to take care of patients with these very rare cancers. Of course, NCCN guidelines are tremendously helpful and they're very accessible and they get updated on a regular basis. But I also, really like the old-fashioned phone a friend approach. Those of us that take care of patients with these rare diseases are always really happy to have our colleagues reach out to us, and we're always happy to provide some advice and guidance because there's a lot that can't be put into the NCCN guidelines. For example, what's the best molecular diagnostic test that I should do on this patient with metastatic iodine refractory follicular thyroid cancer, for example? The NCCN guidelines can't quite get that granular. And so reaching out to your friends and colleagues can really help a lot, I think.
Absolutely. Well, this has been great. Thank you for your time and insight, Dr. Wirth. I really appreciate it.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review to tell us what you think and what you want to hear more about. Oncology Peer Review on the Go is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or at Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.